Good morning, Louise Torres, on behalf of the panel.
Morning, gentlemen.
Eric Klingon on behalf of Appley, Your Honors.
Good morning. And gentlemen, have you both signed in?
Yes.
Wonderful. Okay. Mr. Perez, whenever you're ready, if you wish to come on up, please.
Yes.
Good morning. Thank you for listening to our case. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I can.
Yes.
Okay. This is a custody case, and when I did file the appeal, we are clear on the understanding that in the custody case, the trier of facts, the one who's looking at the evidence, had broad discretion, which should not be overturned unless there is abuse of discretion. So that's why in our brief, we outline what we thought is the criteria for abuse of discretion. In this case, we were relying on Landrum versus Chippenham and Johnston Willis Hospital, Inc., where the Supreme Court of Virginia basically outlined, identified three principal ways by which a court abused its discretion. And in this case, we discussed all three of them. And in all three of the situations, we believe there was abuse of discretion in this case. Specifically, the first criteria was when a relevant factor that should have been given significant weight is not considered. In this case, we were looking at the code, section 20.124.2b, which specifically directs the court that the court shall assure minor children of frequent and continuing contact with both parents when appropriate and encourage parents to share in the responsibility of rearing the children. In this case, a big issue was whether physical custody would be granted to the father in Fairfax or physical custody would be granted to the mother who moved here to Fredericksburg. And we put a lot of evidence indicating that it would be better for the child to be in Fairfax because that will assure more and frequent contact by both parents due to the fact that the mother, even though she moved here to Fredericksburg, she worked in Fairfax, and she testified that she has some flexibility in her work in Fairfax. So by leaving the child, the primary physical custody of the child in Fairfax, it would assure the mandate of the statute that they both have more frequent and continuous contact with the child because it was easy to work weekday visits. It was easier for both to attend and manage medical appointments. It was easier for both parents to attend attend the school events. Once the child comes here to Fredericksburg, not only that frequent contact was limited to the father who lives in Fairfax, but I think it was limited to both parents because she works here. So there's a medical emergency. It takes at least an hour to anybody to come from Fairfax.
But Mr. Perez, these are factors that the trial court considered in determining that the mother was entitled to physical custody, and those were things that were not as problematic as you had suggested.
My position is that the court did not address that issue at all. If you look at the whole opinion, the court did not address that issue at that factor. If the court would have said, even though I'm a concern that in Fairfax maybe they would have minimal contact, we believe that Fredericksburg is better because A, B, C, and D, or we said why Fredericksburg was better than Fairfax, but there was none of that in his opinion or in his finding of why he thought that Fredericksburg was better than Fairfax. So I don't think it was addressed at all. That's the point. I think it's an important factor that should have been addressed, should have been considered. It's a mandate of the statute, and it was not considered, and there was substantial evidence on it.
Mr. Perez, wasn't the trial court determining which parent would be the preferred custodian for physical custody, not which city to live in?
Yes.
Okay, so if the court decided the mother was the better parent for primary physical custody, the other issue as to where she was going to live is important, but it wasn't determinative, whether it's Fredericksburg or Fairfax. The important element that from which all the rest flows seems that the court thought mother was the better parent for primary physical custody.
And we agree 100% with Your Honor if the court would have said so, but I don't think that's in the opinion either.
And also, I can't remember the visitation plan, but the kind of issue that you're raising, an important one, of course, I think can be addressed through visitation.
Well,
and I don't know if that's not before us, I don't think. I don't think there's any quarrel about that. Typically, that's what would happen, to address what you are concerned, what your client is concerned about, and, of course, understandably.
No, I believe it's not before the court, the issue of visitation.
I hear what you're saying, but I think the issue was which parent would be the better physical primary physical custodian, I think.
And that would be to our second...
And that was the mother, but she lives in Fairfax, in Prince's version, yes.
And that is our second point about when the court make a decision, because in order to determine who's the better primary physical custodian, you have to go through the factors and see what's the best interest of the child. And when we go to that, then we go to the second one, when an irrelevant or improper factor is considered and given a significant weight. In this case, and the court says that this is what tipped the balance, is that it broke his heart seeing a 60-year-old woman working two jobs in which he assumed it was to support my client and his child, because there was no evidence of that whatsoever. But he says, I think, the court says, my heart broke watching a 60-year-old woman that works two jobs and working around the clock to provide a home, and you, a 37-year-old, are not able to provide your home, and she's still in a position to work those hours. My second issue for appeal is that, number one, there was no evidence that my client was unable to support himself or the child. There was no evidence who pays the mortgage in the house. There was no evidence whether there is a mortgage. There's no evidence whether the mother is financially helping my client. There was no evidence whether my client pays was paying rent or not. So I'm not going to get into what's happening or not, but there was no evidence that he was being financially supported by his parents, or otherwise that he's there supporting his parents. So the court make a conclusion, and it actually was a determining factor that he said it tipped the balance.
Mr. President, did he actually view it in the sense of whether there was maturity there in reference to his ability to be the custodial parent? Because there were also other factors, such as the fact that Mr. Lejeron had lost his job and not informed the mother about the health insurance benefits. I mean, he sort of factored all of this in, didn't he, in reference to the maturity factor, along with the financial piece that he mentioned.
He lost his job in October. He was hoping he was going to get another job soon, and actually he got it in December. So it was pretty soon that he got another job in the same position. And it's not the fact, but the mother had insurance already for the child.
But it wasn't the fact that he lost the job. It was the fact that he didn't inform the mother about the fact that the child was no longer covered by insurance. So the court was considering all of these factors in reference to maturity, and there were other comments that were made that are not necessarily factoring in on the maturity piece, such as the mother working and being of a certain age. His mother, Mr. Lejeron's mother. Would that be a fair characterization of what the court indicated?
Well, the court indicated that his mother working two jobs. Number one, he make an assumption that he was living like he was always living in his home with his parents, and that was not true even on the evidence. The evidence showed that he was living outside of his home, and when he married Ms. Lejeron, they were living outside of his home, and it was after they had the child that they both decided they were going to have the child, that it was better for them to move with his parents. So it's not that he had been living with his parents for 37 years. Second issue is there was no evidence as to the financial structure of his staying there. There's a lot of sons who stay with their parents, and he supported the parents, not necessarily the parents supporting him. And third, in terms of the mother's job, it was clear in the evidence that there were times in which the mother was not working. It was like a year or so that she said she was not working. And then afterwards, she decided to work one job. Then at one point, she was working two jobs. And she said at the time of the hearing, she was working only three times a week. So there was no evidence as to why she was working two jobs at one point or not, or whether this was to support Mr. Lejeron or not, which is something that the court concluded and somehow said it tipped the balance against a lot of factors that had to go with parenting, which were against the mother. So going to the second factor again, is I think the court used his emotions and the heartbreak of seeing a 60-year-old woman make his own assumption and somehow penalize my client for it. He just penalized my client thinking that somehow she was working two jobs because he was living at the house with the child. And I don't think, number one, I don't think it's a proper it's a proper factor to consider. His emotions or what he saw about the 60-year-old or whether he was hurt by seeing this, that, I don't think that's a factor. And to the extent that, and the way that it gives this factor, because it was the only negative factor of my client when you drink at the opinion.
Mr. President, I hate to interrupt you. You're into your rebuttal time. Certainly may continue if you wish, but if you'd like to...
No, I would like to keep. Thank you.
Mr. Faggett, morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. Eric Klingon on behalf of Ms. Leisure. In asking this court to find an abuse of discretion, appellant is effectively inviting this court to remove discretion that the legislature expressly and intentionally chose in its wisdom to vest in our circuit court judges. Virginia Code 20-124.3 lists certain specifically required factors that the legislature has directed the judicial branch to consider. But the legislature, in its wisdom, also realized that every case is different. For this reason, they included factor number 10, such other factors as the court deems necessary and proper to the determination. Of course, there remains constitutionally based strictures which still act to limit factor number 10 and protect citizens. An example would be if a court used the race of either party as a consideration under factor 10. Here, appellant cannot point to any constitutionally protected class to suggest the circuit court has offended these protections. Appellant argues that by considering a party's economic circumstance and maturity level, a circuit court would be discriminating against homemakers or young parents or stay-at-home parents. However, the legislature has listed 9 other factors which could easily, depending on the case, ensure that a pauper's parental abilities are given equal footing with those of any millionaire. To hold that the circuit court abused its discretion by considering appellant's maturity level and ability to attend the child's needs would be to engage in legislating a new regime for child custody cases.
Counsel, I hate to interrupt you. I think he's... I asked the question about whether the court was asking the financial question in consideration of the maturity. And Mr. Perez, I think, was factoring that out and indicating it was solely, one, emotional in terms of the manner in which the judge handled it, but two, that it was solely based on the economic part and without any weight to support it. I assume your position is that there are other means and ways that the court could address the financial either inequities that might exist between the custodial and the non-custodial parent in factoring in that determination.
Yes, Your Honor. Our position is, well, going off of appellant's position, is their position is that there was an abuse of discretion.
Yes.
And our position is in fact, no. The court, the record is replete with discretionary calls, and the court was very careful to ensure that the judge was very careful to ensure that he considered each of the factors under 20-124.3, and that includes factor 10, which would address the concerns that appellant feels were not addressed by the judge. That's where some of these factors fall.
I think what he's indicating is that it's under the abuse of discretion is an improper factor that the court shouldn't have considered. My question to you, maybe more broadly, is whether that would be improper to consider the financial condition of the parent.
No, and that's, I disagree with. My answer to that would
that's
no.
That's ultimately
yes.
his position.
I understand that, and that's my argument. Part of my argument is that a parent's economic independence or maturity level, or economic independence and maturity level combined, would fall under the 10th consideration. That factor is such other factors. The legislature has decided that, you know, we can list 9 factors and leave it at that, or we can add this 10th factor and give judges the ability who are hearing the case, seeing the parties, and give them that discretion, which they need.
You're suggesting in your argument that the 10th factor has to have constitutional underpinnings. There's no case that says that.
Well, I'm not suggesting that it has to have constitutional underpinnings.
Then let's look at it because you raised issues that would be clearly improper.
Absolutely.
But just putting it under the rubric of the 10th factor doesn't necessarily suggest what you are saying with a proper consideration. In fact, it is a matter of law. The argument on abuse of discretion is something beyond whether or not the court looked at all the factors that are listed in the statute. I think abuse of discretion has a different standard, if you will. It's not standardless. And I think often, I wish I had the case right before me, but I know one ways of looking at it is the court gave undue weight on an element that isn't particularly material for the decision. The court did not consider a really important element. So I think the argument is really more along those lines, not that the court did not consider those factors, all of the enunciated factors anyway.
Certainly, and Your Honor, I would address that specifically by stating first, there is absolutely nowhere in this record the phrase tipped the balance, or that was what made this court, that was the deciding factor. The judge never said that. He didn't say that. In fact, I can read directly what it says is another factor, not the factor, that I thought was important in this case was a 37-year-old still living with his parents. What does that say about your maturity and your ability to raise a child? And he continues, but he says, he finishes with not a positive factor for you, sir. But he doesn't say that was the final call. And in fact, this court has ruled multiple times that there's no requirement for a circuit court judge to state the weight that he has given any particular factor. He simply has to, because the legislature directs him to, make sure that he covers each of the factors in making his decision, which this judge did.
I think this is a case, notwithstanding all that the court found, that in many cases we've got two parents, neither of which is perfect.
Yes, ma'am.
Unlike the rest of us who are not in custody litigation, who don't have to be perfect, the court really uses a very fine screen in determining how to make such decisions, which are not easy. What do you believe were the factors that played into what the court finally did here that you believe shows that there was no abuse of discretion?
Well, I think that a particular factor, which I have a limited amount of time, but a particular factor that I think the court did make a determination of to some degree was when the court asked the mother on the record, and she didn't confer with counsel in her answer, he said, considering where you guys live right now, if you were to live closer together, would you be amenable to a shared custody arrangement? And my client said, absolutely, without any hesitation. There wasn't a, can I talk to my attorney or anything like that. In addition, I think the judge also took into account her education level. I think the judge did take into account the employment issue, which was raised here and was raised before, and with regards to the communication, with regards to health insurance. All of these factors were taken into consideration and clearly spelled out. And in addition, I will state that just because I have limited, well, I thought this clock was going this way and it's going that way.
You've got about 7 minutes.
My apologies.
You can make it in 7 minutes.
I will tell the court that appellant did not bring it up in his initial argument, but it is in his brief. He talks about credibility issues between the parties in the court. As this court notes, and I'm bringing with me the most recent case from 2015, Virginia Court of Appeals, Parham, Parham versus Commonwealth. I only have the record number, but it is published, 0772-14-1, where this court stated, the law is also clear that determining the credibility of the witnesses and the weight afforded the testimony of those witnesses are matters left to the trier of fact. The fact finder is not required to believe all aspects of the testimony of a witness. Instead, it may accept the parts of a witness's testimony it finds believable and reject other parts as implausible. The court has that discretion as well. And the court, as Judge Annunziata just stated, the court oftentimes in custody cases finds both parties lacking in some way, lacking parental skills to some degree, lacking communication skills to some degree, and sometimes lacking in terms of evidence and exhibits and credibility thereof. But the court weighs all of those things together, and this court has been very clear that it is not going to go beyond or inside of those determinations, because it's the judge who's there to see the witnesses, to evaluate them, because he sees how they testify. He sees how they communicate. These are things that don't jump off the page. And that's why a court of appeals or a Supreme Court is loath to look beyond what the credibility determinations ultimately were between the parties. And in this case, I believe that both parties, if you look at the record entirely, both parties had their faults. Each party had its warts. But ultimately, the question is, did the circuit court weigh all the factors according to the law? Did the circuit court weigh the credibility of witnesses according to the law? And did the circuit court provide a fair and just determination as a result? I believe it is clear from this record that the judge did do those things. And on both sides, though inconsistencies may have been found, it was equally clear that the judge provided a fair and just result. So anything else I can answer, I'm happy to.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Perez?
Thanks again.
Just a few things in rebuttal. Number one, when counsel said that the court took in consideration financial circumstances and there are other ways to remedy the lack of financial circumstances in the code, I agree with him. But the court, but in this case, they took against the appellant his financial circumstances, like he was unable to support his son, his daughter, and himself. Like disregarding that there's other mechanism in the code to deal when there's economic disparity in between the parties. However, there was no evidence of this economic disparity either. One of my points, and then in terms of about giving deference to the court and whether they had been abused of discretion, I think there's two very important things. Number one, if you read the opinion, when he said the judges and another factor, he was referring to all the factors he had been talking before, which to that point was everything was negative to the mother. This is the only factor. When he said all the factor was a 37-year-old still living with his parents, that was the only negative factor concerning the father.
Mr. Perez, I think one of his points is that the circuit court doesn't have to give an ascribed number to the amount of weight it's giving to one of the factors. It just has to consider all of the factors. So how then would that be an abuse of discretion if the court gives more weight in its mind to the educational factors of the mother and what she could provide there versus the maturity factor of the father?
Well, first, number one, we argue that just because he did not notify the mother of the of not having the health insurance, if it's the only maturity factor of himself, versus a lot of evidence concerning the mother that showed lack of judgment with the kids, a lack of putting her priorities over the priorities of the child, disregarding some medical needs of the child in order to take an advantage against the father, fabricating evidence, not communicating with the father, hiding the child from the father, going to a trip and leaving the child with the third party, and then lying to the father about all this factor. These are parenting issues. This goes directly to the parenting issues. And that being given less weight than when you put the issue of the financial circumstances and ability to support your child, when we have a lot of cases when mothers specifically or parents somehow they are not the big earners, they don't have the ability to have the big job, but we believe they are the best parent to take care of the kids. This case, there was a big weight given to that factor. Not only that, I don't think there was enough evidence. There was evidence to support that factor. And to the extent that was the only negative factor against the father, I think it's changing the whole opinion, because I do believe, in you read the way, that somehow the appellant was punished for the fact that the judge saw a 6-year-old woman working two jobs, which he assumed that he was supporting both of them. Uh, In terms of the discretion, again, our basis also is, number one, when you look at all the factors and you really look at the evidence in the case, you will see that even if you look at his findings, the result is inconsistent with the findings. I'm not questioning the findings of the court. But if when you look at but the issues that deal with parenting, that affect parent, and there was no evidence presented by the appellee in which they somehow questioned my client's ability. Not only that, there was evidence that before there was litigation, she would say, you're a good father, I was going to leave the child with you. They never questioned his ability to be a good parent. They never questioned that being with him was a good solution. They never questioned his maturity at all. And somehow the court came with this conclusion as the determining factor against the father, because if you read this, I don't see any other negative factor against the father when there were very serious issues concerning the mother and whether this is a good example for a child to be raised by a mother with these kind of principles and these kind of ideas, and whether a mother who basically has a motto that basically the means justify the effort justify the means, which I don't think it should be rewarded. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to come down and greet the council.
Thank you.
This is always tricky. I'm letting you out first.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.